The end of the dollar is nigh. The interest that the US government has to pay on its debt passed an ominous new milestone this week. China, meanwhile, is building the infrastructure to replace America's role in the world, replacing both the dollar and control over key trade routes. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. What's worked out is a bit of a finance special edition this week on Trumpet World. A lot of the biggest news from several of our regions are economic news. But don't turn off economic facts and figures. They can seem remote, complicated, even boring until the economy tanks suddenly and they're suddenly the most relevant pieces of news to your life. And one of these figures is yield on US debt. I'm not investing in US treasuries on a regular basis. I doubt many of you are. But these rising yields have massive implications for everyone everywhere. So to hear more about this, we'll go to our US correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is a really serious story. The overall national debt in the United States is on track to hit $40 trillion this week. It's not quite there yet, but it will be there before I come on the show again next week. And so I usually make it a habit here on Trumpet World to talk about the national debt every time it hits another trillion milestone. The last time I talked about it was when it hit 39 trillion, and it doesn't seem like that was that long ago. We're getting to a point where if I keep this up of talking about it every time it hits another trillion, I'm going to be talking about it a lot because the debt's going up quickly. But this is more important than just the psychological milestone of hitting another round number. Like I said, the national debt's big. Here at the Philadelphia Trumpet, we've been warning about it since the 1990s and before. So this is something that we talk about a lot, but I feel like this new milestone, it is different. Not only are we hitting $40 trillion in national debt, we're hitting more than $1 trillion in interest. That's an all-time high for interest rates, which is also in excess of our defense budget, about $800 billion. That's not including some of the extra money they've put towards the Iran war, but that's our baseline defense budget is about $804 billion. So that puts us in violation of something economists are called the Ferguson Law. It's after financial historian Niall Ferguson pointed out that nations and empires often collapse when the cost of servicing their old debts exceeds the cost of defending their borders. It's not a law of physics, but it is a general trend you've seen throughout history. Roman Empire, Soviet Union. Like when you're spending more on your debt than you're spending on your defense, it's a bad sign. So America's now past that milestone as well. And so other nations and other creditors can see that we have $40 trillion in national debt. We're spending $1 trillion a year on interest. Our interest payments are more than our defense budget. And our creditors are quite logically on their part demanding higher interest rates. If you have bad credit, you get higher interest rates. That works for people, that works for nations. So that's another new record we hit this week, is that the interest rate on a 30-year bond is now about 5.24%. So we're actually have the highest bond interest rate since about 25 years. I think 2001 was the last time bonds were this expensive. So the interest rates on the bonds are how America borrows money. That means the rate on our national debt is also going up. And altogether, we don't have all of our debt in 30-year bonds. That would be bad if we did, because then we'd be paying a 5% interest rate overall. The U.S. government doesn't want to pay that 5% interest rate, so it's trying to sell shorter-term bonds at a lower interest rate. But if you average out all the bonds, the 30-year bonds, the 10-year bonds, the short-term bonds, what they call the blended rate is about 3.5%. So that's the effective interest rate for the $40 trillion we owe, is 3.5% on $40 trillion.
And even the, like, there's significant downsides to rolling things over as well, like to issuing the shorter term debt. Because if you issue a 30-year bond, you don't need to worry. Like, America usually just borrows money, and then when they have to pay it back, they borrow the money again. So a 30-year bond, you don't need to worry about borrowing money again for 30 years. You do a 5-year bond, and in 5 years' time, you need to go back to the market and say, hey, we need another few billion. And so this shift from long-term bond to short-term bonds has also meant that even if America's debt keeps rising at the same rate, the amount of money that they'll need to go to the market to borrow goes up every year. They're constantly having to persuade the market to lend them more and more debt. So issuing short-term bonds, it's a short-term expedience. It brings that interest rate down. But in some ways, it quite quickly makes the U.S. Treasury's job a lot harder.
Right. That is an enormous point I feel like a lot of people overlook, in that of that $40 trillion we owe, about $9 trillion of it, so roughly a quarter of it, is in bonds that expire or that mature this year. So this year, we are going to have to refinance $9 trillion. That means in order to pay back those creditors, we're going to have to sell, because we're running a deficit. In order to pay back those creditors, we're going to have to sell new bonds at a higher interest rate. So the $40 trillion question I feel like everybody should be asking is, at what interest rate does America go bankrupt, basically? According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, they figured that America would no longer be able to function as a nation if half of tax revenue was going towards interest. And they did the math and basically figured out that the blended interest rate would have to be 8%. It's 3.5 right now. It would have to be 8% before you're in a case where half of every tax dollar collected is going towards interest on the national debt. And you would not have enough money left over to run the nation, and no one in their right mind would lend you more. So that's a sobering statistic, because you could look at this like, oh, well, 8% is quite a bit higher than 3.5%. We've got a little bit of time. Although the speed at which it could, our blended interest rate could jump up to 8%, could surprise you. And the fact that like 8% is not like this huge, astronomical, unreasonable number. When I was in kindergarten, the U.S. was paying 8% on its national debt. I wasn't very aware of that fact at the time. I had other things I was thinking about. But within my lifetime, you have had 8% on the national debt. And if we returned to those days back in the early 90s, when you were paying 8% on the national debt, half of all tax revenue would go towards interest on the national debt. We would have nothing. We would not have enough left over to run the country. No one in their right mind would lend you more, and you would be in a financial crisis. This is the big takeaway here. Is like it's not even so much, well, how high does the national debt have to get before America falls apart? America could easily fall apart with our current $40 trillion national debt. We don't actually even need, if the percentage is right, $40 trillion at 8%, we can't function. Like I said, so there's a couple ways you could get to a bankruptcy standpoint. Is one, you could keep your current 3.5% and just have the national debt itself get so big that you're paying 3.5% on such a huge number that you can't function. Or you could actually just pay the current national debt with a higher interest rate. And so this is something where, like, one of the great financial investors of our time, Warren Buffett, says that if something can't go on forever, it will stop. And he said that specifically in regards to the national debt. It's like, we cannot keep adding another $1 trillion to the national debt every year and having our blended interest rate inch up a percentage point every year and this to go on forever. At some point, it's going to stop and the system's going to crash. And really, we're just probably one bond market crisis away from having that crash happen. All you need is interest rates to go back to what they were in the 90s. And we can't function with our current national debt. That's why Elon Musk was so adamant with Doge that, like, if you don't get the national debt down, like I said, yeah, just one bond crisis away from catastrophe.
I mean, you can tell U.S. authorities are concerned about this because of the big story that we didn't get time to talk about on last week's Week in Review show, and that was this yintervention, the U.S. joining with Japan for the first time since the Asian currency crisis, I think it was in the 1990s, to jointly prop up the yen. And at first sight, it's like, well, what does that have to do with everything Andrew's been talking about? Well, it's that Japan has had very low interest rates for a long, long time. They're concerned about deflation. They're concerned about their currency becoming less and less valuable over time. And that can kill economies because there's no point really spending, because if you wait another few months, the thing you want to buy is going to be even cheaper. And then because of that, well, businesses aren't getting any money. So they start laying people off, and then people are concerned about the future. They save more. And it's kind of viewed as this deflationary spiral. Rightly or wrongly, central bankers really don't like deflation. So you lower interest rates really low. You make it really easy to borrow money. So in theory, people borrow lots of money and spend it, and you start to lift the economy back up. What was happening in Japan, for a long time, Japan had no interest rates, zero interest. You borrow $1,000, and in a year's time, you pay back $1,000. So what happened was, if you're a big institution with a lot of money, you go to Japan, you borrow $10,000 from the Japanese central bank, you then go to America and you invest that in US Treasury bonds, considered a pretty much safe asset, pays you a little bit of interest. You know, we're talking, this is a few years ago, so we're talking, say, 3-4%, not the highs that they are at the moment. A year later, you get that money back, you go pay off your loan, and you pocket the interest. Your loan hasn't gone up in the meantime. And with deflation, actually, the amount that you owe in US dollars may have gone down over that time. So it's just easy money. And even the Japanese central bank was doing this, selling yen. Well, they wanted to try and make the yen a little bit weaker. They wanted to help stimulate Japanese industry. So they're selling yen and buying dollars to try and push the price of yen down. They've now got a big stash of dollars sitting in their bank. Well, what do we do? Well, we want somewhere safe to put it. Ah, we'll loan it to the U.S. government. So this was soaking up. I mean, this was part of the reason why interest rates were so low. All of this money, America's being kind of subsidized by Japan and Japanese economic policy. A couple of weeks ago, the value of the yen starts absolutely tanking. Like, not, okay, it's going to make our products on the international market a little bit cheaper, but we're not going to be able to afford to import fuel and food kind of cheaper. Like, the economy is going to a pretty bad place. So the Japanese government, the logical thing for them to do would be to take all of these treasury bonds that they have in US dollars and sell all of them and use that money to buy the yen and to prop the yen up. So, you know, they could have done that. Instead, America got involved and said, hey, we will buy yen and help prop the yen up. Don't do that. Hold on to your treasury bonds. Please don't sell your treasury bonds. And so what America did was sold a whole bunch of its euro-denominated assets and bought a lot of it and then bought all of this yen, basically bailing Japan out, or at least bailing the Japanese currency out, so that Japan can keep loaning to the US government and at the very least doesn't suddenly flood the market with alternative American debt. Because if you're the US Treasury and you're issuing new debt, you don't want to have to compete with Japan that is selling tons and tons of or billions of dollars of old debt that you issued 3-4 years ago. So the very fact that America stepped in, made this unusual intervention, I mean, that shows they're concerned about exactly what you're talking about. They're looking at their rising interest rates and they're saying, we need to act, we need to intervene to stop this from being a major problem.
Yeah, the whole globe is in a major problem. America's national debt is higher in absolute terms than any nation in world history. Japan's national debt, I think, is higher in like relative terms, percentage-wise, even than we are. A lot of like France and Southern Europe's in a very bad position. Probably the only major world power that's in a fairly decent financial position is Germany. And even they have a fairly high national debt. I feel like maybe 60-70% of GDP, which is back in the day that would have been considered high. Now I feel like anyone who's got less than 100% of GDP and national debt is doing is ahead of the curve. But yeah, this is very prophetically significant for two reasons. One is the America's national debt is directly mentioned in Bible prophecy. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are the blessings and cursings chapters, specifically about the blessings that will come on the nations of Israel if they obey God and the curses that come on them if they disobey God. Anyone who's read Herbert W. Armstrong's work, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, knows that America and Britain, the English-speaking nations, are also descended from ancient Israel. And those verses say that, like, if one of the blessings that come when you obey God is, like, you will lend to others and they will not lend to you. So you'll be a creditor nation. Other nations will be in your debt. They'll owe you. And then you can use that fact that they owe you as political leverage for world dominance. But then it flips around in the cursing section, that if you disobey God, like the stranger within your gaze, like others will lend to you and you will not lend to them. I mean, you're no longer a net creditor nation, you're a net debtor nation. America used to be a net creditor nation back before the 1980s. We did still have a national debt in the 70s, but we actually lent out more money than we owed. That flipped in the 1980s and we became a net debtor nation, actually the biggest debtor nation in world history. So that does show that America's national debt is directly prophesied in Bible prophecy. The other important reason, though, is the late Herbert W. Armstrong made what our editor-in-chief considered his greatest personal prophecy. And the personal prophecy is you're basically connecting the dots of primary prophecies to make like a personal prediction. So the primary prophecy in Leviticus 26 is that America would be a debtor nation if they rebelled against God. Another primary prophecy in Revelation 17 is that 10 nations in Europe would unite into a revived Holy Roman Empire that would invade and conquer the United States. Mr. Armstrong kind of put those two prophecies together and made a personal prediction that is panning out that actually the financial crisis caused by America's prophesied national debt will probably be the catalyst that causes Europe to unite. And so now we're looking at this and we're seeing that like America is the world's superpower. Our military is stronger than the next 10 militaries combined. So to have a foreign superpower come in and invade America is definitely going to take a huge change to the world's current geopolitical system. And right now, it looks like the main way that, like, America's global predominance could topple, leaving a vacuum for another superpower, is a bond market crisis. The fact that, like, if bonds went up to 8%, America's now spending more on interest on its national debt than everything than the rest of its government spending. The government can no longer function. America can't fund its military. The superpower collapses, and then from that collapse, nature abhors a vacuum, as they say. Another power, the Revelation 17 power, rises to fill the void America left behind.
And I think that does bring me to one of the stories I wanted to talk about from Europe this week. But that also brings Asia into the picture. So maybe we'll hold off on that for just a couple of minutes. Let you finish up the stories from the English-speaking world, Andrew. And then we'll keep talking finance as we look at Europe and China coming together with Jeremiah.
Yeah, and a couple other stories here from the United States that I just thought were, like, really noteworthy to mention. One, kind of a sad story, actually a very sad story, just highlighting the moral decline in America, is the governor of Massachusetts, Mara Healey. She's kind of a lapsed Catholic, has signed a bill into law, basically legalizing infanticide. And when I say legalizing infanticide, it's like said, basically, this bill legalizes abortion up until the moment of birth. So the only thing that would be illegal is for the baby to actually be born and then kill it. But anything up to the moment of birth, even if it's like in the birth canal on its way out, is legal. And that's... really highlight moral decline in America is that this Massachusetts, it's not the first state to do this. I believe it's the 10th state in America where abortion is legalizing up to the moment of birth. And now if you study what the Bible says about when does human life begin, you'll understand that actually any abortion after the moment of conception is the murder of a human being. As soon as the sperm cell and an egg cell unite, you have a separate human being that if you kill it, you're murdering it. So on that regard, it's actually murdering a baby a day after it was conceived is just as bad as murdering a baby after it was born. But the fact that 10 states, including Massachusetts, have legalized this bill just shows what little value you place on human life. To where you're now okay to kill babies. They actually, like, look like a fully formed human and would be able to survive outside their mother easily. So highlighting just the great moral slide in America.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll swap Andrew out quickly now with our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques, as we keep going with some of these finance stories, as this one from Europe, I think, very directly relates to Asia and some of the stories there. And that is that we learned this week that Deutsche Bank is going to be given basically a direct link to China's central bank. They're going to become a clearing bank for yuan or renminbi payments. This is the first non-Chinese bank that's got this status in Europe. It's going to make it much easier for European banks to directly convert their euros into yuan, into the Chinese currency, with pretty long-range implications. Part of the reason why everyone is willing to lend to the US government and sees treasury bonds as safe investments is because the dollar is the default currency of world trade. People are always trading in dollars. Well, people are always going to want dollars. So dollars are a safe investment. But if you buy dollars and you just leave them sitting under a mattress or in a bank account, you are, you're taking a risk, particularly if you're, you're a major company or an investment firm and you've got $10 million. You know, if you or I have our bank go bankrupt, the federal government will protect our savings basically until a pretty high amount. But if you're a business and you've got 10 million, those savings aren't protected. So you don't just, if you've got dollars, you generally don't just park them in a bank account. You want to do something with them. And then you want to do something that's safe and is going to give you a return. And that generally is treasury bonds. So this issue of American interest rate, America being able to borrow money cheaply is very strongly connected with the dollar being the world's reserve currency. So this is why Europe and China coming together and making it much easier to just trade directly from euros to yuan is such a big deal. Now, it's not like they haven't been able to do this before. If you wanted yuan, you could go to a Chinese clearing bank based in Europe and do that. But Deutsche Bank is already integrated with so much of Europe's businesses, so much of its financial systems. This makes it a whole lot easier for a whole lot more people to directly trade between euros and yuan and not have to use the dollar as an intermediary. It becomes something that's available for huge numbers of people. I think the timing of this is really interesting. Maybe it's no coincidence, but like we just mentioned, a couple of weeks ago, you have America selling its euro assets in order to prop up the yen. And it didn't necessarily do that. The yen is in the Japanese currency, but they didn't necessarily do that deliberately despite Europe. They just wanted to be able to support the yen, and that was a way of doing it without hurting the dollar and hurting themselves too much. Europe wasn't all that happy about that, though, to have America suddenly ditch and flood the market with a whole bunch of their assets. So I do wonder whether there's an element of vengeance. Oh, well, we'll go over and we'll sign this deal with China. I mean, maybe vengeance is too strong of a word, but a warning. We have other options. We're looking at other financial systems. We don't really trust you, America, not to stab us in the back and cause us problems. So I think that's interesting. But they're coming now and being able to do this trade. It's going to facilitate trade between Europe and China, make it easier, less expensive, fewer currency fees and insurance or like hedge fees, risks of having currencies fluctuate while you're in the midst of doing a change. And then it makes both the euro and the yuan or the renminbi kind of more of this international currency. The Berliner Zeitung said for years, Beijing has been trying to expand the international importance of its colors and of its currency and reduce the enormous dominance of the US dollar. And it talks about how it's made some progress on that, but it's still a long way behind the dollar. But then says, Beijing is therefore strategically expanding the infrastructure designed to make international business transactions in yuan simpler and more attractive. That's what they're working from. And again, so much of America's wealth, and I mean, maybe wealth is the wrong word because it's built on debt. It's borrowing money to be able to buy a lot of stuff. That ability to borrow fundamentally comes from America's control of world trade. And it comes from financial infrastructure and also comes from physical infrastructure. I mean, right at its foundation, if you start to look at, well, why do people use the dollar? And I mean, there's several steps to get there, but it's all built on this foundation of America just physically controls global trade. I mean, who is it more than any other force that keeps the sea lanes open, that allows global trade to happen? It's the US Navy. It's why the world's reserve currency generally goes to whoever controls the sea lanes. You know, before it was the dollar, it was the pound. And that was when the Royal Navy controlled the sea lanes. And I mean, where do we even get the name dollar from? It's from the name of a town that at some point was in Austria. I think it's in the Czech Republic now, Tala, where there's a massive silver mine. And this is where the Holy Roman Empire mined its currency. And you go back to the days of Spain and Philip II, and they controlled the sea lane. And so the Tala was kind of the global reserve currency, such a default currency that America then named its currency after it. control of the sea lanes, control of sea gates, that kind of global, being the global reserve currency and being really prosperous, it goes hand in hand with that. So when you see America struggle to deal with Iran, a second-rate power at best, closing the Strait of Hormuz, and the Houthis, a terrorist group, closing the Red Sea, these are not minor inconveniences. This is the foundations of America's power under attack. And so I think that ties in the main story from Asia this week that I believe, Jeremiah, you want to bring us. And that is the potential opening up of a brand new type of sea lane, sea gate, that is kind of far beyond America's control.
Yes, that's right. This morning, a 35,000-ton shipping container left China's Ningbo port on its way to Britain. Now, that alone isn't anything newsworthy. Dozens of container ships go from China to the UK each month. But what makes this one very notable is that instead of heading south from China and then following the traditional routes, either transiting the Suez Canal or sailing around southern Africa, instead of taking any of either of those usual routes, the vessel that left this morning is sailing north. And it'll go west across the top of Russia and through the Arctic. So it'll be taking what is called the Northern Sea Route. This is basically a new shipping route that has only just now been opening up, at least as far as the modern era goes, because historically it's just been too icy to be of much use to anyone. But as ice retreats and as technology advances, this region is becoming increasingly accessible, and Russia and China are really trying to open it up as a regular route for container shipping, and they're also trying to stake their claims over the region's resources. The resources are extremely significant in the Arctic. Some 90 billion barrels of undeveloped oil are believed to be there, and also around 30% of the world's untapped natural gas, and vast caches of all kinds of minerals. So that's all, of course, very valuable. But as a shipping route or a sea lane, it's also of immense value. If everything goes as planned, the vessel that left this morning will arrive in Felixstowe, Britain, in around 3 weeks. But if it had taken the usual route across the Indian Ocean, through the Suez, through the Mediterranean, and then up through the Atlantic to Britain, it would have taken around 5 weeks. So this is dramatically faster. And actually, these days, we have quite a lot of Middle Eastern turmoil, including Houthis that are launching attacks around the Red Sea on vessels in the Red Sea and just destabilizing that area. So because of that, most container lines don't want to take that risk these days. So they've been sailing around southern Africa instead of risking a trip through the Suez Canal. And that makes the shipping time take around 7 weeks. Or even longer. So when you compare this northern sea route at just 3 weeks to those kinds of numbers, you see just how valuable this new route is. This is a major shortcut between Asia and Europe, and the shorter distance translates into enormous savings, saving just enormous sums of money in operating costs. Now, this is still not a route that's fully open to business. The vessel from China is going to have to be accompanied by some nuclear-powered Russian icebreakers. They'll be there ready to smash a path back open if the waters begin to freeze. So it's not without obstacles and complications. But despite that, this is an area that is becoming a big strategic priority for many nations, and Russia and China are really the ones who are taking the lead, moving aggressively to dominate this region. And this is significant in light of biblical prophecy and some of those trends that you mentioned a moment ago, because there are warnings in the scriptures of an immense Asian alliance led by Russia, along with China, that will soon take shape, and it will even soon partner with Europe for a time and dominate global trade. We can see that in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 and other passages. And when you study into these passages, you see that this massive trade alliance between Asia and Europe, it will operate in a way that will eventually be openly hostile to the United States and some of its allies. So when we see China and Russia right now pursuing dominance of this new Arctic sea route, This is just one more area where we can really see Asia establishing tighter trade links with Europe. One more area where we see Asia-Europe trade ready to shift into a new level, and where we can see U.S. dominance of the seas really fading. And it is leading to some very dark times for the United States. So it's an important story to keep an eye on. And if anyone would like to better understand this, I would encourage you to check out our article called The Battle for the Arctic.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. I mean, I do think it ties right in. It's like this is the physical infrastructure of this kind of alliance that you've got, this economic alliance that's building between China and Russia, and then ultimately with Europe, this alliance that's aimed at taking down America's financial dominance, blocking them out from world trade. And there's other physical components to that as well. China's entire Belt and Road Initiative, this initiative to try and build more and more overland infrastructure. I mean, I find it just even living here in the UK and being responsible for, say, purchasing IT equipment, like when we order things from Dell and just seeing over the last decade where they come from and the information on the shipping labels and how it shifted to be more and more from inland Chinese factories that come overland rather than kind of being in a warehouse in Europe that is presumably resupplied by sea. That's another physical part of this, building those physical trade links between China and Europe. And then you also have what I was talking about with the banking and the, well, can we convert our euros directly to yuan and not have to use the American currency? And we are seeing this alliance, this mart of nations take shape before our eyes. And I think it's such a fantastic and important prophecy to watch. I think Mr. Flurry was first kind of talking about this around 2010, 2011. And there wasn't much talk about that at the time. And then within the next few years, you had Angela Merkel go visit China more than any other non-NATO and maybe even any other non-European country. People started talking about a special German-Chinese relationship. I mean, we've not reached the culmination of this prophecy, but even where we are now, it's a fantastic example of fulfilled prophecy. So a great story to dig into, to watch Bible prophecy be fulfilled. What else did you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, well, first up, there's another story that I think also ties in to what we've been discussing to a degree. This is about BRICS. That's the grouping that originally was made up of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. More recently, it has expanded to include Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and some other countries. And the BRICS group has made a lot of headlines over the years because of its ambitions to build an alternative to the U.S.-dominated international system. But despite all the kind of flashy headlines, BRICS has really not managed to get beyond words for the most part. The member nations make plenty of anti-American speeches, and they talk big about various plans they have, but they've never been able to build any sort of military alliance or even a trade mechanism. But now, that may be changing. This week, the BRICS nations announced that they are linking their fast payment systems and their central bank digital currencies. So if this happens, it would really streamline payments that they make to each other and reduce costs. And most importantly, it would bypass the US dollar for a lot of transactions. So if the BRICS are able to pull this off, this could be a serious blow against the US dollar. And it could be a move that begins to turn BRICS from being just an empty talk shop into a significant geopolitical group. And then I've got one final story here about some deepening tensions between Russia and Japan. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited the Kuril Islands this week. These are islands that are north of the main Japanese islands, and they're east of mainland Russia. And this is territory that Russia seized from Japan at the end of World War II, as Japan lay in ruins. And Russia has been in control of the northern two Kuril Islands ever since then. But it's an extremely sore spot in their relations. Japan continues to insist that this territory is integral for them. They say that Russia is illegally occupying it. So Putin's visit there, which is the first during his 27-year-long presidency, It was viewed in Japan as deeply antagonistic. The Japanese Prime Minister even spoke out about it this week. So this is another area where we see Japan deeply at odds with Russia. But we should not expect that friction to last. Even though there's real animosity between them right now, we expect Japan to soon actually throw its lot in with Russia and China. So we're expecting a dramatic change in direction there.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. There's another story I just wanted to make sure we brought you from Europe that is definitely worth putting on your radar, and that is that Germany's intelligence services are being given a whole bunch of capabilities they were deliberately denied after World War II. The German cabinet agreed on a more than 700-page package of laws that empowers both the foreign and domestic intelligence services. That's the BND and the BFV. So, and then, of course, the cabinet, this is a coalition. They have a majority in parliament. So if the cabinet agrees it, usually it gets through parliament without too much trouble. The kind of the bigger disagreements come at that cabinet because that's where the different coalition governments are meeting. So it still needs to pass through parliament to become law. But now that the cabinet has signed off on it, that's almost a formality. It seems almost certain to happen. So it's going to give the BND, for example, the ability to manipulate computer networks of a foreign power during an ongoing cyber attack or a disinformation attack, which I think disinformation attack is a loose enough term that's almost like a blanket approval. They'll be authorized, both these services, to access devices, retrieve data, enhanced interception of encrypted devices. The Interior Minister, Alexander Dobrindt, he said the aim is to be able to act actively against our adversaries. Now, there is a lot of opposition among the opposition parties. One said, in the future, agents will be able to take action against citizens without this being transparent and subject to review under the rule of law, as is the case with the police. And I think there's a couple of, you know, it's easy to look at this and say, well, how is this any different to what America's intelligence services can do or Britain's intelligence services can do? And I don't think it is massively. It is giving Germany's intelligence service the same capabilities as what Britain and America's intelligence services and others have. And I think the first point to make on that is, has Britain or America's intelligence services, have they abused those abilities and authority? Oh, yes, absolutely. So it's not like, well, it's just been benign and it's worked out absolutely swimmingly in America and in Britain. So, well, we're just giving Germany the same thing. I mean, you look at those two countries, you look at America and what was going on with Crossfire Hurricane, the Russian collusion scandal. U.S. intelligence services tried to interfere in American elections. You tried to manipulate public opinion, tried to create an appearance that Donald Trump was colluding with Vladimir Putin. I mean, just thinking, like, there's not been enough reckoning with that. All those people that said, yeah, Donald Trump, he did collude with Vladimir Putin, and people insisted on this even after the end of his first term. And they were telling us, you know what's going to happen when if Donald Trump wins a second term, he's immediately going to hand Ukraine to Putin. Has that happened? I mean, we're like 2 years in. The war in Ukraine still got. He did not immediately take office and say, Vladimir Putin, here you go, have Ukraine. I mean, America is still supporting Ukraine with weapons. And yeah, okay, there's a debate about cost and benefit and how much should America contribute and returns on investment and talk about peace deals and things like that. But it's crystal clear he has not taken Ukraine and handed it to Vladimir Putin on a silver platter. So I think if we're being honest, we have to admit all of those fears about Donald Trump being a Russian agent was a load of nonsense. And it was nonsense that was spread and given credence and given the appearance of fact by the U.S. intelligence services and working with the British intelligence services. And then all the things that happened subsequently, you know, where they came out and said, oh, any idea of corruption or law breaking from Hunter Biden, well, that's Russian disinformation. And you had, what was it, 200 intelligence agency, officials come and sign a document all of this talk about Hunter Biden's laptop, that is Russian disinformation. And then we get Hunter Biden's laptop, and it's true and it's real, and it's not really debated that it's real now. So we have seen massive, massive abuse by the US intelligence service. And you look at America Under Attack and what's talked about there. I mean, really the only reason why this didn't overthrow America's democracy was because God worked a miracle. And the intel services, they weren't the only part of that, but they were an important part. So to say, okay, we don't need to worry about what's happening in Germany because, well, that's just the same as what's happened in the United States. That is, I think, a completely naive or false position to take. But then look at Germany's history. It was meant to be different from America and Britain. And so many things about post-war Germany were meant to be different. They weren't meant to have an army. They weren't meant to have an army then, certainly not on the same scale as Britain and America. There was all of these things that it was like, well, never again. We don't want Germany to start war again, or to start using its intelligence service aggressively again. We need to have some special restrictions here. And there was a defense policy spokesman for the Left Party, which, you know, they are the successors to the East German Communist Party. They're not a great group either, but the communists at least remember some of their history. And this defense policy spokesman said, that is precisely a bitter lesson from our history, especially from the Gestapo, that we had to learn and that the Allies drove home for us. You know, there's a lot of people there, even within Germany, that are saying, you know, we've had problems with out-of-control intelligence services in the past. We do need to make sure that this doesn't happen again. They're very concerned about what is happening here. And then you just look into the history of the BND and the BFV and these services. And basically the key player in a whole lot of these intelligence services was Reinhard Gehlen, who was a Nazi intelligence officer who saw that Germany was going to lose the war, saw that when that happened, America and the Soviet Union would probably fall out, and that America would be very interested on the intelligence that Germany had on the Soviet Union. So he traded that, hid it all away so that he could retrieve it after the fall of Nazi Germany, and said to the Americans, hey, you know, you could try me for a war criminal, or I could give you all of this intel on Russia. And in the end, America ended up setting him to found the post-war intelligence services. And then you go back just a couple of decades, you know, in the 2000s, and the German intelligence service is there wiping its records of who was who in the Nazi, like former Nazis working for them. And Reinhard Gehlen is part of the reason why people like Adolf Eichmann were not found until years after the war, because the German Secret Service was covering for them. And then Germany, even other government departments at this point, were taking accountability and were publishing reports into their Nazi roots and how thoroughly they were infiltrated in Nazism. And the German intelligence department was destroying their records. And there have been all kinds of really dodgy scandals. Even since then, they've been involved in some very weird things. There was even one where you had a neo-Nazi murder someone from a Turkish background. And in the room, while the murder happened, was a German intelligence agent, and she claimed to just have not noticed and stepped over the body without noticing it. Like, there are things going on there. So empowering this, giving them all of these rights, that's something to be very concerned about. So keep watching that. We'll let you know once that passes through the German parliament, but that's not going to be that hard. And so you look at what we were talking about the rise of this economic bloc, the rise of Europe and China and these Asian powers getting together and bringing down the United States. Well, you can be sure Germany's intelligence services will have a very important underground role there too. You know, God is getting ready to punish the United States, and it is going to happen quicker than people expect. It's not going to be a long, gradual, drawn-out decline taking course over the time of a century for the United States. It's going to be sudden, and there will have been people working behind the scenes to bring that down. or to make that happen suddenly. So keep watching that story. That is what your Bible talks about. So that's our important news from Europe. We'll go over now to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic, and we'll look at, well, apparently there's a war on in Iran. It's kind of crazy to me that the Middle East is our final segment. We've just kind of adjusted to the fact that that this is going to happen. That's kind of, well, not much change. So we'll look at some things that have changed and that we do need to know about from the Middle East.
Yes, there's a war in Iran. There's also a war in Gaza going on that has been for far longer. And we've gotten an interesting update on that Wednesday. Al-Aqsa TV, which, if you could guess by the name, is Hamas's, one of their television stations, announced that Hamas will compete in Palestinian legislative elections, which were announced in July and are scheduled for November. I apologize, this was something that caught me off guard. I didn't even know elections were scheduled. But if these go ahead, and it's a big if, this will be the first time in 20 years the West Bank and perhaps even Gaza will hold elections for a new Palestinian government. I did say if Mahmoud Abbas, has, the Palestinian Authority leader, has promised this at least four times before and then backed out of that promise. But he's in his 90s. He's not going to be around forever, so something's going to happen eventually. Hamas said that they would compete as part of a broader national coalition, whatever that means, but most likely means they're going to be hiding behind third-party candidates and other proxy parties. And according to polling, despite everything that's happened since 2023, despite their track record of treating their own people since they took over Gaza in 2007, they are still fairly popular, not just among Gazans, but even among Palestinians in the West Bank. This is interesting for us, even though we talk about many other regions around the world. We have an intense focus on Jerusalem and the big struggle around that. And a prophecy in Zechariah 14, verses 1 to 2, says that all these different events that we talk about, the cascading world crises, so many of them are triggered by half of Jerusalem falling into captivity. And Mr. Fleury has written that that's going to involve a Palestinian takeover of Jerusalem, or half of Jerusalem, the eastern half where all the holy sites are, where all the important stuff is, from the Palestinians in the West Bank. And he's even speculated that Hamas getting control of the West Bank will play a major role into that. And depending how things play out, this announcement, these elections coming up, could play an important role in that. And if people would like to learn more, Mr. Fleury has an entire booklet just about Jerusalem and what's going to happen in Jerusalem called Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Great. Well, thank you for that succinct roundup. Did you have anything else for us from the Middle East?
A couple more. Today, Vice President J.D. Vance, who's the point man for negotiations with Iran, has said that ending Iran's nuclear program, remember at the start of the war, that was the whole rationale why the war began in the first place, but ending Iran's nuclear program is now the number two priority for the United States and for negotiations. Opening up the Strait of Hormuz, sorting all that out, that's now America's number one priority, which was not even a problem before the war. I think it's telling just how much power Iran has in these negotiations and over world trade. We're having a feature article about that in our upcoming Trumpet print edition for September. Also, Axios released a story suggesting that President Donald Trump has been being courted by Israeli opposition figures to not endorse Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel's upcoming elections. They're having elections in October as well. And to, at the very least, stay neutral. And I mean, President Trump, he's endorsed Netanyahu before. He's been put on the spot by reporters if he's going to do that, and he's refused to do that. So it's another sign of the growing rift between the two men, which could contribute to the security situation we talked about in the earlier segment.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Thank you to all of our guests this week and for Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We've talked a lot about finance, but I think a big overall theme, the decline, the fall, the curses coming upon the United States, and the powers God is rising up to correct the United States. And a key book to really understand all of that is, as we've mentioned throughout the show today, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. If you've not read that, that is the book you need to really unlock Bible prophecy. That's the revelation that unlocks your Bible, that helps you apply these scriptures that in the King James Version, they're in Old English and they reference countries that don't exist anymore or names of countries that don't exist anymore, and to understand, well, how does this apply to the modern world? How is this prophesying the fall of the United States of America? Well, that book will show you, and it will prove it to you. You know, there are important questions to answer. God talks about, he says, that he's going to have, he promised David a throne. And he said that there would always be a man to sit on that throne. Well, where is it? Or was God not powerful enough to fulfill that promise? Some people will say, well, Jesus Christ. But the tribe of Judah went into captivity and lost their king 600 years or so before Jesus Christ came the first time. Where was it for those 600 years? Was God just not powerful enough to keep it going the whole time, and he had to leave a bit of a gap? Or you can go to the book of Genesis, where God promises Abraham that he will have multitudes of descendants, multiple nations, and that these will be among the most powerful nations of the earth, the most wealthy nations of the earth. Those are the terms that it talks about. And you look at Israel in the Middle East, and if that is it, then you have to put, if you look at that country, Israel in the Middle East, and you compare it to some of these scriptures, you'd have to think, well, he's exaggerating quite a bit here. I mean, it's a pretty prosperous nation and it's wealthy, but it's not one of the most powerful nations in the world. It's not one of the superpowers. So did God exaggerate? Was he not powerful enough to have multiple nations be descended from Abraham the way that he promised? Or are there other descendants from Abraham out there in the world? So you can prove what's in this book, and that book will also help answer those critical questions from the Bible for you. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link in the show notes, but also if you click on the literature tab and you go from showcase to showing all, you'll be able to find The United States and Britain in Prophecy. You can read it online. You can download an ebook to read later. You can order a free print copy. We'll send that to you, and we'd be very happy to do that for free. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.